Hi guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. And I'm your host, Brett King. As you know, Breaking Banks is a global show that we've been running for the last 4.5 years, primarily based out of the United States, but with a real global coverage. But over the last few years, it's clear that FinTech has expanded its influence on the globe. So we've decided to specialize on that, focusing on a new show as part of the Provoke Media Group that's going to get into some of the fintech happenings across Asia. Now, to do that, we've invited to co-host this and to join us at the helm of Breaking Banks Asia, Simon Spencer, who's based out of Australia. Simon, great to have you joining the Breaking Banks team.
Look, I'm really excited to be part of this. I think it's going to be an exciting time for fintech in across the region. So there's so much going on. And I've done a lot of stuff in my career in banks and in startups. So I think there's so much to talk about. And I think, Asia might have been asleep for a little while at times, particularly maybe here in Australia. But I think it's really hotting up. And I think it's, we're getting leadership from all quarters, from lots of interesting, from big organizations and really small, edgy startups. So there's lots to talk about.
Well, it was interesting, wasn't it, that, in respect to Asia, the fintech phenomenon sort of took a while to get going. It was sort of really slow. There wasn't much funding happening. We didn't hear much in terms of, unicorns or fintechs coming out of Asia. And then suddenly it's just blown up. Like, the funding is there. You've got Ant Financial, the largest fintech in the world based out of China. You've got the Hong Kong and Singaporean regulators adapting to, this in incredible ways with the sandboxes and all of that. What's changed? What happened?
Look, I think a whole lot of things. Often people talk about that notion of the perfect storm, and I think in Asia, that probably does actually have some relevance. You've got this perfect storm of open banking coming through the ICOs and blockchain. You've got artificial intelligence. You've got use of machine learning and completely new, highly sophisticated user experiences. So I think it's a really exciting time. People are reinventing what it is to be a bank.
Okay, so tell me about what is going to be the focus of Breaking Banks Asia. Who do you have planned on getting involved over the coming months?
What I want to do with Breaking Banks Asia is sort of mix it up a little bit. I think the American show, your show, Brett, is an incredible show.
It's a global show based out of America, but
it is.
It's all right, I'm just giving you a hard time.
You are, but that's okay. That's how it's going to.
But you are. We are based in New York, and we're on the AM band in New York. So yeah, that's.
So look, what I want to do is I definitely want to see interviews with some of the most interesting thought leaders in some of the biggest organizations. Your big banks across Asia. But I also want to mix it up with some of the startups and some of the people who are looking more on the fringe and more on the frontier, so the fintech disruptors. I also want to bring in some of the thought leaders across the region that are the future thinkers, the Ross Dawsons and others like Ross, who are seeing what's coming.
Well-known futurists, yeah.
Absolutely, and an incredible forward thinker and has perspectives across many, many dimensions. And that's the interesting thing about Breaking Banks. It's about banks, but it's much more than just about banks. It's a very broad landscape. And so we'll see. We've got interviews lined up with some of the largest banks across Asia already. We've also got some interviews with some of the most interesting startups. And then from time to time, we're going to bring in some people from other dimensions. The reg tech area, which is, I think, a really interesting dimension. Reg tech and fintech fit together well. They enable each other, but they also will disrupt one another. And particularly reg tech will drive a wave of disruption into fintech. So I think, and also you can't be talking about fintech without looking at data and artificial intelligence and data privacy and data sovereignty, and particularly in an Asian landscape. Data sovereignty is a major challenge and a question. My first interview actually is one of the specialists in data and data privacy and data regulation and identity, Lisa Schutz. So we will cover a very broad landscape. We'll have a bit of a cadence. We'll do big company, small company, and we'll mix it up a bit. And then, of course, we'll take feedback and we'll adapt and evolve as we go.
Good. Well, you know what the definition of a futurist is, don't you?
Share with me.
It means never being wrong today.
Look,
okay. I can say that. I'm picking on myself, right? So Now that's good news. I mean, you know we're expanding the Provoke universe. Provoke, of course, is the parent company of Breaking Banks, and we're launching 7 different podcasts over this next 12-month period. Of course, you're familiar with Breaking Banks, and we have FinTech 5. We now have JP Nichols' own show, Serial Entrepreneur, which launched recently. We've got Breaking Banks Asia, Breaking Banks LATAM, The Snark Tank from Ron Shevlin's coming up, and we're doing a FemTech show globally. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening under the Provoke Media banner. But of course, I like to think that it all started with Breaking Banks, and it's great to finally have an Asia specialization in terms of our spin-off for the show. So very, very glad that you've joined the team, Simon, and hope to be able to join the show regularly to have a voice as the founder of the concept as well.
No, thank you very much, Brett. It's exciting times are ahead.
Fantastic. All right, well, over to the first episode of Breaking Banks Asia. Let's check out what the future of fintech in Asia holds.
Thank you.
The only reason people are nice to me is because I have more money than God.
The most valuable commodity I know of is information. Wouldn't you agree?
All right, well, welcome to Breaking Banks Asia. I'm Simon Spencer, your host tonight. Brett and his team have built an incredible following in fintech and innovation and venture capital. I'm really excited to be part of the team bringing Breaking Banks to Asia. My approach is going to build on what's been done before, but also try a few new things. So bear with me as we experiment a little bit. Brett's given me a little bit of license, and we'll see how long that lasts. It's going to come as no surprise to any of our listeners that this is an incredibly exciting time for change and disruption and transition and opportunity in the financial services area, and also in the adjacent areas, blockchain and artificial intelligence and more. So I think we've got a lot we can talk about. I think Asia is a really interesting landscape. There's some really exciting things where it's probably ahead of the curve, and there's probably some areas where we're perhaps behind and falling behind. Over the coming weeks, I've got some incredible interviews already scheduled and lined up. I'm going to have a deliberate mix of bankers and the big end of town, as well as the really edgy fintech innovators and out there disruptors, experts and future thinkers. So we're going to mix it up a bit to ensure that no matter what you do, there's always going to be something coming up that informs you, that provokes you, that challenges you, and hopefully inspires you. So welcome to Breaking Banks Asia. So this week we have a very special guest, Lisa Schutz, who's joining us in the Melbourne studio. Lisa was this month awarded the FinTech Leader of the Year by the Women in Finance Award. Lisa is also the founder of Verifier and one of the region's most respected experts in data-driven innovation, data privacy, and data regulation. Say hi, Lisa.
Hi, Simon, and thank you for having me.
Great to have you here in our very first show. But before we jump into an interview, I also wanted to announce that for the launch of Breaking Banks Asia, we've got a competition, and it's co-sponsored by Finovate Asia, so thank you very much. We've got 2 passes for Finovate based in Hong Kong this year. Sorry, we don't have travel and accommodation included. But we might be able to show you a drink at the bar. Finovate Asia is November 7th in Hong Kong, 7th and 8th at the Marriott. It'll have a showcase of some of the region's most exciting and disruptive fintech startups, and definitely, I think, an event not to miss. Details of the competition is going to be at the end of the show. A lot can happen in a week in fintech, and this week was certainly no exception. We saw the continued focus on security and data privacy and the fallout from the Equifax breach, but we also had Yahoo finally admitting that it actually lost nearly 3 billion customer records, basically its entire customer database at the time. The data net is now in the public domain, and it's a treasure trove for identity theft, and really, I think more than that, it's going to be a further catalyst driving international regulations around data breach notification and regulation. And I have no doubt that Lisa's going to have some interesting perspectives on that. This week, we also saw 2 interesting articles. I read two interesting articles. One was a piece in the Australian Financial Review, which had the bold headline, "There's no reason why Australia cannot be a leader in the fintech sector." And I thought that was an interesting, and you know, it's a big headline to go with. But it was also followed a couple of days later by the announcement from Hong Kong about the open banking, and where the governor of Hong Kong Central Bank has spelt out the reforms to the introduction of faster payments and open API standards intended to prepare Hong Kong for a real revolution in retail banking services. And those two articles in particular really demonstrate to me that there's an emerging race on in the open banking area, and it's going to be really interesting to see how different countries across the region take advantage or adapt to some of this, and in particular to see how, say, Australia, that perhaps has bold ambitions, adapts to a rapidly changing regional landscape. So this brings me to the interview today. Lisa Schutz has done a lot of work in the data area, creating a really exciting startup called Verifier, doing verification using superannuation data and other data sets. So Lisa, as somebody who's been working in this space for quite some time, what's your thought on what's going on around us at the moment, particularly in the data space?
Simon, that's a lovely broad question.
It's meant to be.
I couldn't be more excited is the bottom line. I think we're at a really interesting inflection point. And it's funny, actually, reflecting on, you know, everyone goes, I mean, I have a background in strategy. I started out at the Boston Consulting Group. I did my first data-driven startup, sadly, a very long time ago, and sold it to one of the Australian credit bureaus, now owned by Equifax, incidentally. And I now do, basically, Verifier is all about customer-controlled data. So I've really kind of lived the dream, if you like, of the evolution of data use, and certainly in financial services. And I'm really excited right now. I mean, I think there's so many imperatives that mean we really need to change the way we use data. You mentioned the data breaches earlier. I mean, I think there's a major brain-body disconnect, if you like, in the world about data breach at the, you know, Yahoo or the Equifax level, and identity theft. Oh. And for me, I mean, my first point is that understanding has to really change, which is that every time there's a data breach, to your exact point, but I don't think this is well understood, data breaches sound terribly scandalous and exciting on the front page of the business press. But the important thing and the reason why I'm a real advocate of data breach notification is that every single data breach equals a latent identity risk at the micro level. And I think what's missing here is an understanding of how the two things interconnect. And so what that means is if I'm a person who has been affected by one of those breaches, I have to know, because I really have to change my passwords and I really have to mitigate and be more aware.
Is there an issue of lack of understanding as to who owns the data? Is there perhaps a misconception as to who the actual owner of the data is?
Do you know, that's a really funny one, because I'm living that discussion at a global level at the moment. We've been very active at Verifier in lobbying the Australian Productivity Commission, who've been reviewing this. And we're also very involved in what's going on in Europe with the General Data Protection Regulation. And, you know, my bottom line answer to this is I really don't care who asserts ownership. I'm more interested in who has access. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think the disconnect and my general frustration is that what people don't realise is that pretty much globally with privacy law, there is a clear right of access that the person has to their data. And the problem is people haven't tended to be able to access that in any meaningful, useful way. So what I think the latent, the sleeper issue with data is that when I started working in data, it was all about organizations leveraging it in order to gain advantage. And that was absolutely correct for the time. Frankly, I think they've squandered the opportunity. And now it's too late, because the person actually has the right of access. I think you see that in Europe. I think you see certainly pretty much throughout the region a growing recognition. I think that's what's lovely about APAC. It's pretty good at leapfrogging the rest of the world, and we're seeing that. So, you know, I have a funny feeling, and as someone who spent a lot of time working with corporates trying to get their use, get them to use their data better. Wrote a book on it called Decisions Not Data. I guess what I got tired of was trying to convince them to use it. So I say, give it back to the people and let them help everyone.
Do you see, you know, people often talk about sort of the perfect storm and things colliding at the right time. And, you know, the move to open banking, the growth of APIs, the move to what's sometimes called a mesh economy where everything's connected to everything. And then you have, you know, the emergence of artificial intelligence and use of sophisticated data sciences and, you know, block big data and so forth. You have a whole bunch of these things all coming, all colliding together at the same time. You know, it creates a really, really interesting landscape for data, for data-driven innovation. What's your thoughts on sort of what's likely to happen over the next sort of 2, 3, 4 years?
I'm a big believer in technology is morally neutral. And I actually think the answer to that question is, what do we want it to be? And that's where I think the most important conversations are ones about social systems and how we want things to go. And I do not believe in technology determining our future. I think that is reductive. And my analogy would be the advent of the motor car. So if data sharing is like the horseless carriage, if you think about, you know, when it started, you know, they had all the troughs for the horses to drink at down the main street. And then they had horses, carriages, and people trotting around. There were no traffic lights. There were no road rules. People didn't have any safety gear. You know, all of that had to be invented to keep pace with the technology, and it lagged. And I think I'm quoted most recently on the subject as saying, I think we're all going to cringe about what we did with data in 2017. And I really mean that. I think it's the Wild West out there. And so I think the thing is for us as societies to decide our future and then handle it better. So, for instance, I think it is absolutely crazy, things like screen scraping, the idea that you can impersonate a person, pretend to be them and get their data without the data source understanding who is making the request. I think that's nuts. And I think anyone who thinks about it would realise that's not clever. And yet we tolerate that now. I think it is crazy for unnecessary. I'm not saying all honeypots of data are unnecessary, but I'm just saying, why store it? For me, I look at data storage as essentially like a toxic waste dump. Every one of them has a latent risk in them. And anyone who thinks that they're not going to be hacked is dreaming. So in other words, I have no problem with data storage and I'm a massive advocate of data use, but I think we have to get really smart about how we do that. And technology enables things that are not smart. And that's where we need to keep our brains on as humans, as social engineers. And I think the biggest opportunity for us is to harness all that technology. The biggest threat is that we abrogate that responsibility to technologists. It just doesn't work that way.
There's obviously been some really interesting discussion around the use of data, the use of data sciences, and even some areas where perhaps the use of data has been somewhat questionable. And firms like Cambridge Analytica are an illustration of a firm that's very much out on the frontier of what you could or couldn't or shouldn't be doing with data. And so I think your analogy of the Wild Wild West is an interesting one. Do you see a focus around sort of data rights management and data ownership and being able to sort of have some mechanism where people can actually own their data? And what are you seeing in that space?
I think there's a whole lot of issues bound up with that. So firstly, I think the way I would describe privacy is no one expects to walk down the street either naked or with their pajamas on. We present ourselves differently in public to how we do in private. And I think the most important thing is that as citizens, we need to start thinking of our online and our data selves in a similar way, in which case not everyone gets to see all my data. and I need some degrees of control over that. So that's the first thing. I think if we all understood that better, we would start to require and demand different things. I'm a big believer that ultimately what will happen is that countries and geographic blocks, so Europe, so Asia, will start to have kind of standardized levels of permission. So that I won't have to dredge through all these ridiculously crazy terms and conditions, but there'll be like a low tolerance to data sharing privacy permission level, you know, a moderate and a high, something like that. So I know what I'm signing up to and there's some standardization, because I think at the moment all the work goes back on the person.
Mm. So you used the term Wild Wild West earlier, and you know, there's some interesting firms out there right on the frontier of doing things that is perhaps it's questionable. It's certainly open to debate, and the firm Cambridge Analytica probably comes first to mind as a company that's definitely pushing the envelope as what you can do with data sciences to manage sentiment, to perhaps manipulate sentiment, and to drive particular outcomes. And for those of you who aren't across Cambridge Analytica, they were certainly involved in some of the voting around Brexit, and our friend Donald Trump certainly was involved there as well, and so forth. So it's an interesting firm doing interesting things. And, you know, if that's the Wild Wild West and that's the frontier, what's your thoughts, Lisa, in terms of governance and what you should do and what you shouldn't do?
You know, I think that's a really interesting one because, yeah, what you can do and what you should do are two different things. And I think there's two parts to that. I mean, government will always lag a little on this, but I think as a community and as data scientists as well practicing, I think there's a lot that can be done. So, for instance, I mean, the whole thing about predictive analytics is in essence, you can do some amazing stuff, and clearly Cambridge has proven that you can. But I think as a general rule, it's changing the way we think about media. It's changing the way we think about citizenry. And as we start to understand how the technology can impact that, we'll then as a community have to set some standards. I mean, I give a really base level non-political example of this, which is that those who know me will understand, I tend to shop for books online, not clothes. But unfortunately, one weekend I thought I'd, you know, really change my shopping habits. I thought I'm missing out, suffering classic FOMO, and I decided to shop online for a weekend. And my lame example of what's really ineffective, as well as not particularly, I would say, okay, is that ever since I've been stalked by shopping ads for clothes, in that case, it's inefficient and it didn't get the outcome they wanted. The truth is algorithms always make mistakes. And so, yes, you can end up in a hall of mirrors. You can end up with terribly misleading representations, distorting how citizens behave. You can just have lame, stupid stuff like I bought a computer and I got stalked for several weeks with cheaper versions of the same computer. Well, that's just dumb advertising. Through to, you know, just totally lame kind of banner ads that have got nothing to do with it. So there's the sublime to the ridiculous in a way. And I think it comes back to, we almost need a code of conduct like physicians, a first of all, do no harm. And an understanding that we are licensed to be active is dependent on the democracies and the countries that we inhabit, and that each of them has their own set of rules and requirements, and we absolutely have to understand and have a moral compass. So for instance, I'll give you a classic example of that, where in Australia recently we had some drama with some use of predictive algorithms for one of our government agencies, and that involved some really aggressive messaging out to people who potentially owed money to the government. And operationally, that didn't seem to be particularly well hooked up to an ability to appeal, an ability to handle the increased call volume, and caused a lot of distress and potentially, you know, some suicides, you know, horrible. So I think we have to be really conscious to the impacts of the models we use. Mm. If it's going to impact our democratic fabric, if it's going to impact someone's ability to, so for instance, I mean, I've done a lot of work in credit risk, you have to be extremely conscious, and in most jurisdictions, there are things you can't use to predict risk. If it's going to affect, if it's going to have someone get a really aggressive call or letter that threatens them with bankruptcy if they don't pay blah within a certain time range, then those models have to be handled appropriately because there's downside risk to the person. My example of shopping's a bit lame in the sense that the only thing there is a waste of my eyeball time, I guess, and a little bit of frustration. So, you know, horses for courses. But I think in general, the way to look at, I genuinely think, I mean, the title of my book is my mantra, decisions, not data. You really don't, data science is really 1% of the problem. It's really understanding the decision engineering that you're doing. And if it's going to hurt people or compromise the social fabric, then you need one set of rules and approaches and quite another if it's, well, I actually want an ability to override that ridiculous shopping algorithm, but similarly, the cost's pretty low.
It's an interesting challenge for the audit community because, you know, in the past, if you were an auditor, you might do a data audit or an IT audit, and you were looking predominantly at the data itself, whereas increasingly there's a need to audit the algorithms and audit the models. And you know, when you start to work with very complex machine learning-based models, auditing one of those is actually incredibly complicated and requires a set of disciplines and skills that are probably well beyond the classic sort of education that an auditor might get at a university.
Oh gosh, I couldn't agree more. And frankly, the irony for me is a lot of the learnings around governance have already been really experienced in consumer credit risk. So I've been involved for a very long time, and frankly, in the end, people were playing with neural nets like 10, 20 years ago, and a lot of that sort of the beginnings of deep learning and machine learning were thrown out of credit risk modelling because the machines are so obtuse that while you might get an answer that's highly predictive, you can't explain how you got there. And of course, the problem with that is not only robustness over time and all those nice real kind of data science-y kind of problems, but frankly, how do you know if it's not actually effectively discriminating on race, gender, or whatever? Mm. And so I genuinely think in the future, we're going to have to get a lot tougher. I actually think makes me sound like a complete fossil, which I do feel like from time to time, but honestly, some of this stuff's already been done before and found to fail for the precise reason that you can't explain it. It's nice that the machine can work it out, but can you communicate that to the community? Is the community okay with that?
That starts to take you into the sort of territory that, you know, the science fiction writers like Asimov took us to decades ago around, you know, the robotic three laws and the need for to build in controls into the technology or into the software so that it makes ethical choices. So while the auditor may not be able to do a fine grained audit on the model, potentially the software itself can have those ethical controls built into it to ensure the right sort of balanced and reasonable outcomes from a social perspective.
Well, it's a question of trust, isn't it? And I think two thoughts on that. So to your point about skills, I was at a law conference recently, and basically my point there is if you can't, as a lawyer, critique a model, your lifespan as a lawyer is fairly restricted, I would say. I think coding is our new language and we're all going to have it. And understanding basics of data science, I don't think is too onerous since you can do a multiple regression in Excel. It's not that hard. So I think there's a real skill gap and that needs to be bridged. And as to morality in code and in software, I think all the dramas around blockchain and forking and et cetera point to the fact that classically there, you've gone from counterparty risk to coder risk. And my standing joke on this one is with driverless cars, I want to know what the wildlife protection morality switch is. Because if I happen to be driving along, and I'm going to give an Australian analogy here, but I'm about to hit a kangaroo, what if the person sitting there programming, sipping their latte, really loves preserving kangaroos? Are they going to kill me or the kangaroo? I need to know that. Like at the moment, a lot of moral choices are made on the fly and we trust humans to use their best judgment at the moment of truth. When we encode morality choices, while they might seem good at 1,000 feet or way back in the sort of ivory tower, how does it look on the ground? And I think that is, you know, that is going to be the challenge. Mm.
That's a really interesting example, the kangaroo, because I think it was Volvo or one of the vehicle manufacturers is doing some testing at the moment, and they're doing some testing in Australia, and they actually have a great deal of difficulty predicting the kangaroos because, you know, as do human drivers. I live in the country and have had more than a few run-ins with kangaroos because they behave in a random way. They behave in a way that perhaps isn't in their best self-interest. And so for the driverless car world, and for that matter, for the broader use of machine learning, how do you deal with things that are somewhat random, where it's really hard to predict those sort of things where it doesn't happen logically? So, you know, kangaroos are a great illustration of that sort of situation coming through.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, even with the whole privacy discussions, I think we often land in the wrong place, which is what grumps me out on the privacy conversation is most of the open data opportunities are at the aggregated. Like, yes. If you look at government efficiency, you do not need to go down to the individual to get better systemic behaviours. Mm. And I mean, like, monitoring of key institutions, their efficiency, their effectiveness. I think what tends to happen is we tend to personalize it, whereas there's a whole lot of stuff that is no regrets, absolutely no regrets. Like, there are probably many places, I know I live near an automated dock. Pretty much everything is automated and there's no humans walking around and there's no risk. So, of course, you could have automated cars. I think they're remotely controlled at the moment, but I think that's a perfect place to use driverless vehicles. There's no humans, there's no kangaroos, all good. Similarly with open data, there's so much that can be done at an aggregated, depersonalized level. Mm. The way people tend to obstruct that very useful use of data, which I'm passionately supportive of, is to give the corner cases where people are at risk.
Yes, the kangaroo jumping out on the road type. Single.
Yeah, and I really do not want at dusk to be driving in a car that doesn't have my ability to override, for your exact point, for those that don't live in Australia. But at the same time, I'm very happy with a whole lot of lower cost activities that use driverless cars.
There's shifting gears for a moment, using the car metaphor. We've talked about the industry's talked about the digital economy, and for the last year, I think the word digital has been dropped off because I think people have finally realised that it's just the economy. Yeah, whether you're a mining company or a farmer or a retail business or a bank, it's all digital. It's digital in some shape or form, and if it's not, it's on its way to, you know, via Internet of Things and blockchain and various other technologies. So, you know, it's all the digital economy now. Well, it's interesting that the instrumentation we use to manage the digital economy is, for the most part, fairly analog. It's collated data that's gathered quarterly, highly aggregated, and it's used to provide instrumentation for a highly real-time or near-real-time economy. So do you see that changing a bit? You know, do you see us getting to a point where we have instrumentation that's fit for purpose for an economy that is infinitely more sophisticated in this decade than it perhaps was two decades ago?
Look, I certainly do, in the sense that there are so many stats that we rely on where, you know, there are plenty of private data feeds that could substitute and be much better. I have to say two things to that. I guess the first is, as someone who, I mean, Verifier, our business, basically connects unusual data sources or sort of out-of-sector data sources like Super to solve lending problems, for instance. And whenever you're connecting data silos, it's like a goat track. So I know that in the future we'll have all these wonderful new data feeds, but crikey, it's difficult to actually hook them up. So I think that's a bit of a process. But I also have to say my bit for innate bias with data is thinking of things that are recorded in bytes. And, you know, some of my most excitement is actually about quantifying human intelligence. So, you know, the use of prediction markets, I think, is absolutely fantastic, because there is so much evidence that people is by using essentially weighted people using points to adjust a market signal can have highly accurate reads on things that are out in the world. So I think I see a dashboard over time of much better signals about GDP and price indexes, et cetera, house prices, et cetera. But I also see a world where we harness what people can see, that tacit knowledge, better.
Brilliant. So I wanted to talk about the area of digital identity and what that means to you. So Lisa, what's your thoughts on sort of where we are with digital identity and where do we need to be?
I think digital identity is core to our collective future for a few reasons. The first is, as someone who's very much engaged in people having access to their data, the sleeper in the whole issue of customer-controlled data globally is, in order for Lisa to have access to her data, you must know it's Lisa. Therefore, the demand for digital identity services grows exponentially as you start to enable people to access their data. So that's the point, I would say, to start with. We're not doing a great job now. I mean, identity fraud is an issue already, but the risks and the demand's gonna grow. So we need to really fix it. And I would say historically, the way identity has worked, it's been a government-driven initiative. And when you think about all the potential for data sharing, it's going to become at least equally weighted private public, and that requires something new. I also think, you know, I think there's a few pieces to that, which is we need to, as a community, think more deeply about the use of identity. So for me, there's three kinds of identity use case, if you like. The first is Lisa proving that I'm a citizen or that I have a right to drive a car in a jurisdiction. For me, that's a primary use, and it's all about the actual specifics of the qualification or the rights of citizenry matter. But if it's me proving that I exist to apply for a loan, that's sort of proving my identity, the actual specifics do not matter at all. And then if it's me enabling data sharing between two silos by proving that I am the same person, again, the details about me are not relevant. And so those three use cases look very different. And where I'm getting to with that is right now, across financial services, health, and so on, there are multiple databases with passport images from me, driver's licenses data from me, probably, I hate to think how many hundreds of databases have identity information about me on them. Yeah. And that's honeypot for hackers, right? Nutso when you think about it. So I think we need to get very much smarter about a federated model of proof of identity without sharing of identity data. Because otherwise we're just asking for trouble, and we're already seeing that we are.
Yeah, and you see, you know, organizations that have extremely strong security credentials still make terrible mistakes and still compromise their data sets and those data sets get exposed. So I think, you know, the honeypot is a real issue. And I think that the average person on the street actually is intuitively and probably rightfully so suspicious about how well governments, or for that matter even banks, are protecting their data assets. And that sort of takes you to sort of, you know, is biometrics the answer to all your problems? You know, if I do a retina scan or a fingerprint scan, does that solve all the issues?
And I am a vigorous and well-known no to that, for one simple reason. Let's assume that hacks occur, and they do. So what are you going to do when my biometric data is compromised? It can't be reissued. It's unique. And what I would say, and I whack my economics hat on here, there's an asymmetry to risk and value here. So it suits institutions to use biometrics because it is unique. And if they get hacked, the costs are worn by the person. Likewise, the costs are borne by the person if access to an asset or some other form of access that's of value means their person is compromised. So for instance, I never want to be in the situation where I can't hand over the keys to the car. If someone wants to take my car and put me in a personal safety situation, I want to hand the keys over. I do not want to have my fingerprint involved in any way. And there have been cases like that. So I never want to give access to a bank account through a retina scan, because what if someone has to forcibly put me at risk to get it? No, I'd rather give them the password, take the money. So if someone can solve that, that's great. But until they can, I don't think people anywhere in the world should agree to it.
So going back to your analogy around the roads, you know, we don't yet have the signage and the traffic lights and some of the other infrastructure we need to have to perhaps travel at the speed that we'd like to travel at.
Yeah, and look, the counter, and what I think's missing in this whole debate is it's biometrics or apparently nothing. Whereas I think there's an actually much smarter way to do it, which is, why are we using biometrics? It's to prevent identity theft and other issues. So why not do it in the inverse? So if I change, there's a number of situations like with emails and things where if I change a password, I get a SMS and an email. But if someone uses my identity credentials, I get no warning. Mm. So the way to fix identity theft, in my view, is the opposite, which is don't take my biometrics, but rather alert me as a citizen to uses of my passport. That'd fix it. That's what we're missing, and that is a much lower risk to the individual. Mm. But, and here's the problem, it's higher cost to the community as a whole.
Yep. RegTech versus FinTech. What's your thoughts there?
Well, that's funny because we were trotting along basically because doing Verifier because I felt that people sharing their data would be able to improve outcomes in financial services. And then one day someone said, are you a fintech? And I said, what's that? And then I thought, well, that sounds like we probably are because we're financial services and tech. And then about a year or so ago, someone said, are you a regtech? And I sort of thought about it and I thought, well, we are implementing responsible lending and automating compliance. So I guess we are. So the funny thing is I kind of sit on the of the combo of both fintech and regtech. But I, a guy on a panel that I was on, I thought put it rather aptly, which is that he said, fintechs are carnivores and regtechs are herbivores. So I think I'm a herbivore in that case. So we work with large lenders and fintechs, helping them all basically meet their responsible lending obligations. And frankly, if you would ask me if I was an investor, which one would I play? I'd go RegTech because I think two things are constants at the moment globally and certainly throughout APAC. An increase in regulation and a demand for better outcomes for communities. And that's all about regulation. So, you know, whereas fintech depends on the market. I mean, China is the great boom market for fintech. And the second APAC alternative finance industry report that was recently released pretty much highlights that. Australia came a noticeable second. But I think different factors are driving it. So I think in each market, fintech has a different role to play. I think China fintech is all about essentially leapfrogging what was already in place, whereas Australia, I think fintech is complementing the existing environment. So fintech's different depending on the different environments, whereas regtech's pretty constant.
What's it like to create a fintech startup or a regtech startup, depending on who you're talking to, particularly in the Australian market? What's your thoughts there?
Interesting one. It's an odyssey. I think that's a fair description. It's an odyssey, in our case, a clear vision 4.5 years ago, which we've relentlessly pursued. The market's now catching up with us. That's really validating. But it's tough. It's tough even being a herbivore, because everyone wants to talk about innovation, but innovation's something that you kind of want to talk about, you don't necessarily want to do. And in fact, that's one of the reasons I founded or co-founded the RegTech Association in Australia, was because we felt there was a latent opportunity in the sector, but that it's very hard for corporates to ingest startups. It's also, in fairness, very hard for startups to learn how to be corporate ready. It's very hard for regulators and the community to understand what's possible. And basically the missing is the really constructive dialogue, but it's really hard. It's really exciting and I love doing it. I have an amazing team, but you know, up days, down days. And I think what we're going to see though is a really interesting, we're at a tipping point. And I think that everyone talks about disruption a lot, but in finance at least, it hasn't even touched the sides. And I think the next 5 years will be quite remarkable.
This week, you also saw you be awarded the Woman in FinTech Award. What's it like being a woman in FinTech?
Interesting. It's funny because I certainly don't think I've had any advantages from that. And I do get some strange comments, like I had someone at a meetup go, gee, you realise you're the only woman in the room. Mm. And I'm like, actually, I haven't really noticed that. Thanks for pointing that out. Mm. So it just kind of like these are the things I'm interested in and I just get on and do it. And it seems to me that really it's only those on the outside looking in that really point that out. So I have noticed, though, in the last 6 months, there is a growing, certainly in Australia, a growing emphasis on diversity. So I suppose I've had a bit of a free kick. There's a few panels where people are demanding 50-50 male-female representation. But I'd just like to think I could get on the panel anyway. I think it's fine. I mean, it's actually an advantage in many ways for two reasons. And frankly, this would be what I'd say. I really believe in market forces. Mm. And frankly, I have a real advantage in fintech, which is I think differently. And I am very good working with techies and with corporates and translating. And I think those who don't have women on their teams are really losing out. I really genuinely think that. And most really hardcore data scientists and techies, I find really appreciate the difference, and I really don't understand what all the fuss is about. Having said that, I also think there's a real arbitrage opportunity. I mean, the women I know, the women founders I know around the world who are running companies in this space, genuinely, I think, tend to not get access to the funding that they should. And frankly, I think there's a massive arbitrage opportunity for savvy investors. And, you know, that's arguably their problem, not mine.
Thank you very much. That's brilliant. I'm also, I was influenced by an interview that Sally Ride gave when she was the first woman astronaut on the space shuttle. And she was asked the question, you know, what's it like being the first woman astronaut? And she said, well, you know, she will actually like it when people stop asking about what it's like to be the first woman astronaut, and it's just what is it like to be an astronaut. And I think the focus on women in fintech is an important one. It's a need to equalize and perhaps leverage, you know, some of the brilliant talent that's available to us. But ultimately, you know, success will be when we stop talking about it.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the only other thing I'd say, I'm not into, I just think let everyone get on with it and see where the cards fall, because the truth is women are incredibly good at fintech for a whole lot of reasons. But I would say this, I think if this lens of women in fintech is of any use, then like all change, as Gandhi would say, you have to look to yourself. And imagine this for all the guys out there. Imagine you walk into a room of women and you have to norm to how they behave. That is what life is like for most women in fintech most days. The truth is that I don't think any of it really much matters if we all just understood a little bit of the fact that we all speak. I mean, those throughout the region and in the US and Europe will be hearing two extremely loud Australian accents clanging down the wires or the bites or whatever. Everyone speaks with a gender accent. And the quicker we learn to appreciate that and adjust ourselves to the other gender. And what I would say is women I have the blessing or the curse of working in a lot of very male-dominated environments, and I have to norm to the male tribe every day. And that's a load that all women in these spaces carry. So I look forward to either one of two scenarios, an even balance where everyone, there's a more blended norm, if you like, or in the short term, everyone to realise they speak with a gender accent and just reflect internally, because that's all that's needed, and the rest is just hype. Change from within.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much for that. And thank you very much, Lisa, for joining us in the first episode of Breaking Banks Asia. And I very much enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon.
So that's pretty much the show for today. But before we break, the competition. So what I want you to do is follow us on Twitter. So that's BBanks Asia on Twitter. And if you're interested in actually being in the competition, tweet out about something you've seen and something that's good, or retweet something we've posted, but make sure you include the hashtag #BBA on it. And I'm going to pick two different people over the next couple of weeks and send them a ticket for Finovate in Asia, for Hong Kong. So with that, feel free to also reach out to me if you've got any tips on the show. You can email me at simon@breakingbanks.com. If you've got any suggestions on people we should interview or any other feedback. If you're listening and interested in sponsoring Breaking Banks or Breaking Banks Asia, feel free to reach out as well. And we also have some really excellent guests lined up during November and December. So from me, have a great week, and I look forward to speaking to you all next week on Breaking Banks.